You're listening to KBOO Portland.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable energy, and living, and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
I'm Annie Warmke.
And today we've got another installment of Dead White Scientist series, kind of sort of an installment, but today we're going to talk about the early homes of America, or they weren't all born in log cabins.
So, wow, and, I didn't know they were.
Well, you know, I think we have this myth of America, you know,
America.
and of course, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. And then the next thing that happened was the Pilgrims showed up and they had Thanksgiving. And then we all moved into log cabins and George Washington
became president,
made the world safe for democracy. And, yeah. And that is America. And along the way, there were a few cowboys who, you know, robbed banks and shot Indians.
You know, if I had studied your version, I would have given up on education.
Well,
boring.
Explained the state of education in the United States. Anyway, so, but like most things that we learn in school, this is pretty much wrong.
Wrong or not true?
Both. And some of it is intentionally wrong. And some of it is just, you know, when you make things generalized, you tend to get rid of the nuance and the color of, I mean, because people actually live real lives. They're not parodies or picture books that are well adapted for children's stories.
But I was thinking about when I read the Diary of Abigail Adams, and what I got from that was there was this huge marketing piece that was going on about the British especially marketing us as, you know, we're hicks with coonskin caps and we don't really speak proper English and we fight and get drunk. And I was thinking, well, didn't we inherited that from the British?
But so far it all sounds pretty accurate.
I know, but it's just this whole, it was a marketing piece to get people here or to keep people away.
Yeah. Well, when you think about marketing, I mean, the Pilgrims are kind of the quintessential marketing of these noble religious refugees who found, you know, Plymouth Rock and came out and then befriended the local savages who taught them how to get through, you know, when we had Thanksgiving and all of that. And it's interesting to note, you know, you might not have ever thought about it, but how did they communicate with the Indians when they first showed up?
You know, this is a trivia question for a game, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good trivia. Well, really what happened and is one of the first people they were introduced to is a fella who they nicknamed Squanto because they couldn't really pronounce his name. But Squanto is the one who taught them about how you would use fish, you know, to fertilize corn and to grow corn and things of this nature. But before they met Squanto, what they did is they essentially scared away the locals. They chased them down. They found where they had stored their winter food, and basically the Pilgrims stole it from the Native Americans.
Well, weren't they spying on them to figure all that out?
Well, no, they dug up the mounds. They took all their corn. Then when they ran out of that, they dug up their burial mounds, and they stole anything that was of interest. And then they found their summer homes, and they looted those. So our good Pilgrim refugees were essentially
living out their Christian attitudes and
there
beliefs.
You go. And Squanto, of course, had been stolen as a
that.
Yeah, he had been I'm glossing over it. He had been kidnapped as a slave and sold to the monks in Spain. He had been to England. He had learned English, and the story goes that when he was brought to the Pilgrims, when they were trying to communicate with Indians, basically one of the Indians like, wait a minute, I know a guy who knows this lingo, brought Squanto back. And the first thing Squanto asked was, do you guys have any beer? You know, so
in English.
Yeah, because he spoke very fluent English, you know. So he's like, hey, I want some beer. Haven't had a good point in a while, mate, you know. So this is the...
That's interesting. He did have a British accent, I'm sure.
I'm sure he did. Anyway, so this is... But if you think about now, this is the frontier, right? Well, what is the thing about frontiers is you don't have a lot of the resources. So the early homes very much were similar to the Native American homes because that's what worked in the climates that these folks existed in. And although the British or the other European immigrants would have liked to emulate the homes that they were used to back in the mother country or the fatherland, they just didn't have the materials. So you work with what you have. And one of the first homes that was popularly called was a newcomer wigwam, you know, which basically you would dig a hole in the ground about 3 or 4 feet deep and then cover it with sticks and build up the walls with some sod or branches.
Even covering it with hides and things too.
Yeah, you could cover it with almost anything.
Whatever you had, you'd use what was available.
But then you're taking advantage of the thermal mass that was, you know, inherent in the earth. When you get below the frost line, it's going to have a certain comfortable temperature. So that's what the wigwams were doing. And you know, you do with what you want. But we have this vision that they immediately started hacking log cabins out of the wilderness, and that just simply wasn't so. First off, I mean, the British had no history of log cabins. Log cabins was something that was really imported to America by the Swedes and the Finns. So it wasn't until much, much later, really the late 1700s, that the British started seeing some of these and going, you know, hey, that's not such a terrible idea. If all we've got is an axe and some logs, we can make a house that way. So there's, you know, you use what you have available. And if you don't have a sawmill in your local community, you can't really make boards to construct a more traditional, in quotes,
no, but
British
they didn't
home.
Even have, like, when I was taking barns apart, I could almost tell the age of the building by the marks that were on the beams and the purl of the building. It would show me whether they had hand-hewn it, hand-cut it, hand-stripped it of its bark and squared it up, or if there was a piece of machinery that had done that for them. So and even with a log cabin, I mean, they had to have similar sized trees that sat on top of each other so that they laid properly so the chinking could go in place and close up all the gaps. And if you just logically think about the stories that we've been told, which we're not taught to think logically lately, or maybe not even when I was a kid to question those things, it makes sense that they really didn't build those kind of buildings at the beginning.
Yeah, you'd have to have a super abundance of wood and a real lack of tools.
Well, I think there was plenty of wood.
Well, there wasn't.
But weren't the Pilgrims really sent here? They came for one reason, personal reason, which they said was to have religious freedom. But then they were sent here to get wood for the motherland.
Yeah, in fact, of course, one of the big motivations was there was a lack of wood. Not only for the brewing of beer, which was the major industry back in England, but also for the masts for the sailing ships.
Yeah.
I mean, you think
they
the wooden
the
ships.
Oceans. That's
well,
right.
And they cut down all their good wood, so they needed a good source of wood. And it was interesting when I was looking at this because one of the things that financed many of the early trips was bringing back sassafras. And I'm not sure if that was like for sassafras tea or the roots or whatever, or if it was the wood itself. I don't know. It was unclear.
The tree itself would have produced a lot of products. I mean, yes, for tea, and I think probably other medicinal qualities for that tree, but it's a softer wetter wood. It would hold moisture, so maybe it was used for things that needed to be more wet. And it grows quickly because it's what comes out of the forest land when you clear cut. That's one of the first trees that comes back. But there were other kinds of houses, because I know after that first sort of bit where they were trying to stay warm and everything, their next group that came along were the stonemasons, the stone cutters out of Ireland and Scotland and Wales, and building houses out of stone.
Well, there was a lot of, what you're getting into is sort of the second wave of housing. Because when you first arrive in the new country or any new place, you basically want to get out of the rain. You know, let's put something up quick that will provide us shelter, maybe get us through this first winter. And then once we've settled in, you know, assuming we didn't all die of the plague or froze to death or whatever, get killed, which happened to a lot of them, then we're going to build something a little more traditional. And if you have stone available and you have stone masons who know the skill, then that's what you're going to build out of. If you have wattle and daub, you know, that was a very traditional British mechanism where you build a timber frame structure and then fill in between the supports with sticks and mud and horsehair and manure. And all of that to sort of glue it all together and then earth plaster over it. And those are some techniques that we incorporate right now in some sustainable building practices. And then you build a thatched roof, because that's another skill that you knew and is sustainable given the materials you have on hand. Those were structures that were early on where the British settled. You had maybe some of the Irish stonemasons or the Scottish stonemasons who built that way. The Swedes, log cabins, that would have been some of theirs. But in the early days, they're mostly digging holes in the ground like the wigwam. In Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, there were the Quakers. And, of course, the Quakers, that was William Pitt's...
Pitt or Penn?
Penn, William Penn, yeah, Pennsylvania. Anyway, he they founded this with the Quakers. Well, they dug
they
out
founded a
city
village?
Of Philadelphia, and he started selling off lots. And they sold off the lots along the river, the Delaware River. And there they would dig into the bank of the river bank, and make their homes essentially out of hollowed out caves. You'd dig into the side of the hill, have a south facing front, put a facade over it, and live quite comfortably in these homes. Sounds a lot like an earthship, right?
I don't know this that comfortable. I think you'd be warmer in the winter and cooler in the summer, but if it rained a lot, it would be
muddy. Well,
you get
groundwater, you get muskrats coming in
mold,
you'd have
a lot of visitors. Bugs.
Everything is relative, you know.
Okay.
It's better
warmth. I'd be going for warmth.
It's
so,
better
okay.
than lying out on the street.
No, and I'd be fine if bugs want to come visit because I want to be warm. So,
well, one of the problems that happened there is, of course, they were not very British, you know. You're living
in
a cave.
Enough.
Yeah, so William Penn was apparently ridiculed a bit when he went back to England about all of his colonists are living in caves. Ha, 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 you must be whatever. And so he issued a proclamation. In fact, it was in 1686, the Proclamation Concerning the Caves of Philadelphia. And he basically said, I was tolerant with you people in the early days, but no more. You've got to vacate all the caves within 2 months, you know, because this is all about freedom. So do what I say, you know.
Yeah.
And people kind of ignored him. So at that point, he sicked the police on him and started, you know, evicting and collapsing in the caves. And so the tolerance.
Nothing ever changes.
Yeah.
The thing I was thinking about, too, is that, you know, If you realize that this is a way that you could live sort of comfortably compared to what the technology was available to you, that why they stayed, you know, the reason they stayed, and I guess because people are mostly sheep.
And why they stayed like
yeah,
in
why
Philadelphia?
They stayed, yeah, and to have somebody tell you can't live like that, that there's something wrong with you, and, you know, I suppose God was involved in it too because they were Quakers, but... It's just hard for me to look at that and say, why would you stay when there were so many other places you could go?
I think we have a different vision of America. I mean, it was like beyond here, there be dragons. I mean, if you go outside of the village walls, it's pretty dangerous.
Yeah, but by then there was New York. There was what's the town in Long Island?
Well, Philadelphia by 1775 was the largest city in the country.
Right.
40,000 people, which is still relatively small by our standards. But before I go into those, I wanted to remind you that you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you once again that it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God.
Thank God. So the end of the world as we know it began somewhere, and we're talking about some of the early homes of America and maybe some of the myths. I mean, already we're finding out that our founding fathers were born in caves in Philadelphia. In fact, the very first European born in Pennsylvania, his name was John Key, and he was born in 1682 in a cave in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
There you go.
Well,
the cavemen of
Pennsylvania. But I just want to say, when I brought up the point that you could have gone somewhere else, that there was wilderness, and some of these people by then had understood about farming because everybody had animals and raised chickens and had eggs and things. But they could have gone to New York. They could have gone to, what's the place in Rhode Island?
Newport.
Newport,
Rhode Island was actually
Newport.
The fifth largest town in the country.
They could have gone to what's the southern one?
Charleston.
They could have gone there. There was a lot of activity and probably lots of jobs.
I mean, a lot of people did leave.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
I mean, that's why that's how we settled this great continent, this
yes.
land from sea to shining sea. And you know, I think America is founded on people being annoyed by their neighbors.
Yeah, and that's also our marketing shtick.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, so I've got a story.
Okay, tell
about
me a story.
People who left because they couldn't stand what was going on. And so my ancestors, my great-great-grandparents were illiterate farmers in the South. And they, I won't go into what they were doing, but they were
moonshiners.
They were sabotaging efforts by the rebel soldiers.
Okay.
And anyway, so my great-great-grandmother, her name was Nancy Vance Tipton, she decided that in order to keep from being killed when her husband went off to join up in northern Kentucky to join with the Yanks, that she would take her three young children and what she called a great yellow dog and her mule, and they would cross down through the Cumberland Gap and come up to northern Kentucky and wait for the war to be over, because she didn't want to get hung. And so she, once she went through the Cumberland Gap, she stayed in trapper shacks. Lots of people trapping furs and lots of money to be made doing that. And at one point, she was in a trapper shack. It was a log cabin, a simple little one-room log cabin with a stone fireplace. And she could hear something on the roof, and she could hear the rocks from the fireplace falling to the ground. And she got her rifle. She was a shot. She was good at shooting things.
A sharpshooter.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so they're waiting because they know something's going to happen, and the dog is barking like crazy and everything. And all of a sudden, a mountain lion comes right down through the chimney opening and spills out onto the floor, and the dog starts to attack, and she shoots and kills the mountain lion.
Okay, so you're wondering why people didn't leave Philadelphia because someone told them their house wasn't pretty, huh? Okay.
Well, there were a lot of things. There were a lot of issues then, but the point is that people could leave and figured out how to leave.
Well, and when you mentioned the fireplace, you know, firewood was quite a thing. In fact, the average colonial
you mean a commodity.
It was a project. I mean, it took about 40 cords of firewood to heat the typical home over the course of the year, to heat it and provide cooking.
Like just a little log cabin, you mean?
Just a colonial home. I mean, they just say on average, so I'm sure smaller and bigger. But a cord of wood, if you're not familiar, is a stack of wood 4 foot by 4 foot by 8 foot. So that's a lot of firewood, 40 of those.
Well, they're cooking and heating in an inefficient building.
Right, and it was very, very inefficient. In fact, Ethan Allen, the famous, patriot,
Isn't he the furniture guy?
No, he is now, but he was probably burning furniture to keep warm. But yeah. There's a story that he was going to have a meeting in his house and started getting everything heated up at noon. And by the evening meeting, he had gotten the house all the way up to 53 degrees, which you would find quite miserable. I'm sure at the time it felt fairly roasty toasty.
Well, they also used to build fireplace where you could sit inside.
Right.
Because you were cooking in it. It was really like its own room in a way, and it had a bench on the sides,
well,
and
some
you could
people
sit
would,
in there to
write
and do things.
Because
yeah.
the ink would freeze in the house.
Yeah.
About 90% of the energy would go out the chimney. So you're burning the firewood, and almost all of the heat from it is going up in
just
smoke.
Sucking it right up,
so,
yeah.
So actually, there was Ben Franklin is famous for trying to develop the Franklin fireplace to,
stove.
Address this. And then there was another fellow, Count Rumford, who developed a more practical fireplace, and it became quite popular. And you've seen them where the back of the fireplace is more narrow than the front, and it's pretty shallow.
Yeah. Well, that's how most of them are constructed.
Well, that's because it was a better way. Mm-hmm. It blew the heat out into the room instead of straight up the fireplace. And so firewood was a major motivation, you know, throughout the year. And most of these homes had to have a 20-acre firewood plot.
A woodlot,
yeah, because it would take a full acre of wood to heat for a year, and as you cycled through it, it took like 20 years before the first acre you chopped down had replenished itself. So it was a big issue. And so the homes, so we get through that first thing of we're going to dig little things in the ground and we're going to dig into caves.
I mean, dig a hole,
get through that first few years. Then we're going to go towards more traditional European housing, which didn't do a very good job here in America because the weather is a little rougher,
Well, it depends on where you are, but yes, in the Midwest, certainly, in the East.
Sure, and even in the South, you've got heat and mosquitoes and things like that.
Well,
then as we move forward, one of the big things that changed our life here in colonial America, post-colonial America, is the Homestead Act. And this took place right in the middle of really the Civil War in the 1800s. And what the Homestead Act said, it was in 1862 it passed, and the government said, we'll give you 160 acres of land if you go out there and build yourself a home within 3 months, and that home's got to be at least 8 by 10, so 8 foot by 10 foot. So that then led to everybody go west, young man, you know, to head out into the Great Plains. And one of the things you know about the Great Plains today as well as in years past is there weren't that many trees.
Well, but I just want to say that in some regions, there are many counties in the Appalachian Mountain area that fell into that. And they did come and they did build log cabins right away because they had to do it within those 3 months. But then they built stone.
All right, you're back on
houses.
The stone.
So, I like
okay,
the
they
stone.
Were all being stone. So,
all right.
but there would only be log cabins where there were trees. You get out into Nebraska.
That's right.
You get in, and you'd have to be maybe along a river or creek, you'd find some trees. But for the most part, they built what they were referred to as soddies or sod houses where they cut down in, and they cut sod into strips that were about 2 foot by 1 foot by 6 inches.
Sod being grass.
Yeah, and it was prairie grass, so it was that.
Really
the
thick.
Buffalo grass, very thick and weedy. So you'd stack that up to make your walls.
Like little biscuits, I bet.
Yeah, like bricks.
Yeah.
Really, like
mm-hmm.
2 foot by 1 foot by 6 inch bricks.
Yeah.
And then leave places for the windows.
It would
leave
be so miserable, though, because
it
would smell and it would get wet and it would have bugs and
pioneering
muddy.
Pioneering is not for the faint of heart.
No, it is not.
Right. And if they were lucky enough to have a little hill, they'd build a dugout where they would build it so into the hillside. Well, we know from building into hills, there's groundwater issues, things of that
but
nature.
But it does create thermal mass. It helps you control the temperature amazingly well.
And if that's all you have. And then later with the advent of baling machines, they could build what were called Nebraska-style straw bale homes. And those are still
Some of them today. Are still, yeah, know. Well, they're still building, but some of those houses still stand, two-story beautiful houses. And again, you know, this was, in a way, biomimicry. They were imitating, humans were imitating animals, and it's really brilliant that they started doing that instead of just trying to do the same thing over and over again. And it's where we're going today, really, because if you think about it, how humanity has progressed and is thought of as success is to do exactly what William Penn was making people do. He's knocking down all the stuff that was efficient and reusing materials, and they went to building with wood, which was not efficient, and it's still not efficient. We build with blocks, it's still not efficient. And so we're moving towards the idea of using solar, passive solar, so that we can capture the heat like you do in your car when you're in the parking lot and it's all shut up. And we're also using thermal mass like they did with digging into the walls. And that's where we're going to go. People aren't going to have a choice.
Well, it seems to go in a circle. You know, everything old is new again.
Uh-huh.
When you're first in an environment where you do not have access to outside materials, you have to build sustainably because you're going to use local materials. You're going to be in build in a way that is going to keep you warm in the wintertime, cool in the summertime. Otherwise, you're going to die. So, you know, I'm sure people do it wrong. We just never read about those people because they're dead before they can write stuff down.
Or maybe they didn't know how to write yet.
Yeah. And then, of course, we also see how government influence begins to influence how we build our homes. Because people are trying to do the right thing, for instance, the cave homes of Philadelphia. But then government steps in and says, no, 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 tut, tut, tut. That is not appropriate. That's not British enough.
Makes
that's
us
not
look
whatever.
Bad, yeah.
Yeah, my friends are making fun of me, so therefore you must change your behaviors. Then we get government coming along saying, hey, we want you to populate the West, but you better build a house quickly. So now you're going to have to build these homes relatively quickly. What do you build them out of? Whatever you have around. You know, if all you have is dirt, you're going to build a house out of dirt. As the railroads started coming through, then people had access to building materials that were not native to that particular environment. So there began really a business, what they would call claim shanties, where people would sell people the materials to build a tar paper house.
It like cost a about kit.
Yeah, like $15. Here's your house. You can put it up in a day. Well, then you've met the requirements of your claim.
Yeah.
Now they were crap, and one little candle would set your house on fire, but
or might blow it down. But you know what else was cool, is that they, as you go west in your little trek you're talking about, then they hit upon people who built with adobe, built with and made clay bricks and things like that, which we're also starting to do more of again because it produces a cooler environment where it's too hot.
Right. We think of the Americas, you know, the colonial America as, you know, we got the Pilgrims and then Daniel Boone, and it's all Eastern based. But really, the early settlement of America was out in the desert Southwest.
Yeah. So
in
where's fact, the oldest house?
Yeah, where the oldest it? Building in America still standing today is the Taos Pueblo, which is out near Santa Fe. And it was began being built around the year 1000. So it's 1,000 years old. It was continuously inhabited, this little series of buildings there, for about 400 years.
That's cool.
So most of the oldest homes in America are actually adobe buildings built in the southwestern United States.
Everything old's new again.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our award-winning producer, Adam Rich, and we want to thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother hopefully probably told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and use thermal mass for your building.
All right, with vegetables. Till next time.
Mother Earth will sing and her children will be healed. We'll be right back.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Making contact.
Making contact.